Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Roy Taylor, global top innovating entrepreneur and C-level executive, and Roy is the corporate vice president and head of global channel sales, AMD. Now, Roy, wow, just an amazing background. Thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Roy, you're a legend. You've done so much. So can you share some highlights and useful lessons learned from your remarkably long success history with so many different areas such as entertainment, technology, and entrepreneurship?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the introduction, which makes me blush a little. In my 20s, I won a very large contract from IBM Microelectronics to be their sales and marketing rep company in Europe, which at the time set a lot of records. When I was in my 30s, I went to work for NVIDIA and set up their business in Europe from scratch, starting out in my bedroom originally, and then turning that into a $300 million business before I moved to go and live in the United States and work in NVIDIA's headquarters. During my 40s and my tenure in America with NVIDIA, I developed a number of worldwide programs which helped propel them to record sales. And, of course, today I now work at AMD, and I'm having a lot of fun helping turn around their channel business. In terms of lessons during that time, there are some that I'd like to share. The first thing I would definitely like to share is that the need to think big. It's often said that it's much easier to borrow $100 million than it is to borrow $100,000. And I think that truism also extends into the IT business and to business in general. If you're going to do something, then be bold and make an impact. And an extension to that is not to be intimidated, and particularly so in IT. One of the things that we see over and over is that in the technology area, innovation has the capability of creating tremendous upheaval and changes. And we've seen once mighty companies like DEC and Compaq and Nokia go through terrible changes or in some cases disappear. And those changes will continue in our industry. So the ability to think boldly and act big and to not be intimidated, I think are important lessons, certainly from my career success.
Well, Roy, when I look at your tremendous history, you've done all of those things. You think big, you work big, and you're agile, and you've had an impact on the world. Now, you're a notable leader, a top leader, in fact. So what are your top leadership tips?
Yes, thanks. The most important tip I have is to get the right people. I mean, as we've seen over and over in history, one particularly brilliant person can make a huge difference. If we think about Gandhi or Mandela or Steve Jobs. Well, the same is also true on smaller scales and in different areas for leadership teams. A small team of very, very good people with one or two extraordinary people can do wonderful things. And that leads me to my second tip, which is to try to work with small teams. I believe that small teams can move faster and communicate better than big teams. And so I always prefer to work with teams that are no larger than 100 people wherever possible. And my next tip is that to always consider that velocity is the key. A wonderful idea that takes too long to get to market stops becoming a wonderful idea when that happens. And so we have this tremendous need to move quickly. And I love that phrase that Facebook had for a while, which was, move fast and break things. And that brings me to the caveat to the need to have velocity and move fast, however, which is to understand that if you have a company which is successful at having velocity and moving fast, then going quickly in anything means you inevitably crash sometimes. And so I think it's important to understand that sometimes getting it wrong or crashing is the inevitable result of moving quickly. And so be understanding and build that into your ethos and to the way that you lead your teams.
You know, those are some really great insights, and we're going to drill into some of those insights when you talk about AMD. But before you do that, let's talk about some of your top tips for innovation and entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I think my first tip is if it's difficult, then get excited. If your idea or concept is impossible, then get it patented and funded. Very often, I talked earlier about the need not to be intimidated. We've also seen throughout the history of our industry that again and again, ideas which seemed to be impossible were achieved. And so my first tip is to, and this also goes back to being bold and thinking big, is remember that it's difficult ideas that are the most interesting ones and exciting ones to try and solve. And I think, for example, of when Steve Jobs felt the need to have rendered fonts and was told it was impossible. And today, of course, it's standard. My other second tip for innovation and entrepreneurship, it goes back to people. You could get five great people in a room, give them a table, a pen and paper, and they'll come up with some great way to innovate if they're the right five people. So my second tip is always start with really great people. And then my third tip is something I refer to as STOP, S-T-O-P. Before you jump into action, stop, think, observe, and plan. And take time, even by yourself, if you're an individual listening to this, and I'm sure you're very, very busy, as I know I am. And so I think sometimes it's helpful to actually book time for yourself, as if someone wanted to have a meeting with you. Book regularly time to be alone, where all you're going to do is to think and allow yourself to consider issues that you have and opportunities. And my fourth tip, which also linked to that, is don't rely on your memory. It's interesting that as I see successful people and I meet successful people from around the world, over and over again, some of the richest, the most successful, and the most brilliant people that I know and that I've met simply carry around a paper notepad or a book, a paper book, and they keep notes. And I think that's an important discipline, because we will often, either almost on a whim, think of something which later we'll try and grasp and get back to and not be able to, or be too busy to get back to. And so I know it sounds like an incredibly simple thing, but keep a notepad and keep notes. And then my fifth tip is never have any sacred cows. If something's not working and if something won't react to the forces you're applying to it, move on. Don't be afraid to move on. And I often think when I'm asked about this, about Andy Grove in his book about The Only Paranoid Survive, when they were examining the terrible problems Intel had with the memory business, and people forget that they invented a number of memory products and were very big in the memory business at one time. But under severe competition from new Japanese vendors, they were trying to work out what to do. And in the end, they decided just to get out of it and focus on microprocessors. And the rest we know is history. So don't be afraid to move on or to, you know, sacrifice a sacred cow.
You know, those are some excellent tips based upon years and years and years of experience and actually doing it and achieving a lot of success. So I guess that leads to the next question, and then what attracted you to AMD, and then considering the many options you have?
Well, the first thing that attracted me was the quality of the people there, and this is consistent with everything I've been saying to you so far, and the reason it's consistent is because I really believe it. When I went to when I visited Austin and I met some of the executive team there, I was just really, really taken with the quality of the people. My boss, John Byrne, I think is a wonderful chief sales officer, and he inspires and motivates me every day. Jim Keller is a fantastic architect, semiconductor architect, and I'm thrilled that we have him at AMD. Roger Godori, who came back to us from Apple, is also, I think, wonderful, as is Lisa Su, who runs our business units, and, of course, Rory Reed, our CEO. And so when I met this team of people, I was just really thrilled at the opportunity to come and work with them and be part of their team. The second thing that really attracted me is technology. And I'm going to talk a little bit today about HSA, or Heterogeneous System Architectures. And I sincerely believe that these are going to make a profound change to the semiconductor and technology industry. And so I was very, very excited about that, what AMD is doing in this area. The third reason is may seem abstract, but it's being the opportunity to be part of history. Now, it might sound a little coy, but I believe that AMD is going to be the third biggest turnaround in technology history. The first, I believe, was IBM when Lou Gerstner joined and turned that company around. The second, of course, was Apple after Steve Jobs returned. And I really believe that AMD is going to be the third. And so the chance to be part of history, to be part of something which is bigger than myself and bigger than just, being a wonderful salesman and doing wonderful things in the channel, that's thrilling. And so when you put those three things together, that's why I joined AMD.
Well, it sounds like a remarkable time and a remarkable opportunity, and considering all the talents that you have, and as you indicated, the tremendous talent that's available within AMD. So really a convergence of two great forces to create a perfect storm of opportunity and success. So I guess that leads to my next question then, and you've talked about it a bit already. What are AMD's current plans and future goals? And then most importantly, how will they be executed?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. I think the most important part of our current plan is that we are embracing change. If you look at some of the interviews with some of the executives going on around the industry right now, I believe that some companies feel challenged by the huge changes taking place, and some may even be intimidated by them. We are not. We're not afraid of tablets. We're not afraid of the smartphone revolution, and we're not afraid of the Internet of Things. In fact, not only are we not afraid of those, we're excited by them. And we see opportunities everywhere in the revolution taking place. Some of the upheaval taking place is still yet to be fully appreciated. For example, we think we're going to see tremendous change in the server market and the server industry. And in all of these areas, whether it's a mobile or mobile PC, desktop, server, tablets, all of this change we think is creating tremendous opportunity. And so as part of that, we're going to continue to invest in our core competencies where we have leadership. We're going to continue to invest in CPU, continue to invest in GPU, and of course APU, a category which we are in the middle of just establishing and showing some wonderful leadership on. As well as investing in the technologies we have, we're going to also expand them and extend them. So, for example, we recently introduced to the world Mantle, a new API to take advantage of CPU, GPU, and APU technologies, and we're really, really excited about that. The other part of our current plans and goals are to tell our story, and I'm going to talk a little bit during this podcast about the global challenges and about benchmarks. We believe that we have wonderful products and that we also have a great story to tell. Explaining that story, and by the way, thank you for the chance to talk to you today, because having a chance to take the narrative and to explain the things that we have is actually a very big part of our current plan, because under analysis and in the final analysis and in using independent and verifiable data, we do have leadership and we do have wonderful products. So another part of our plan is to take that narrative to tell the story. Another part of our plan is also to continue to invest in semi-custom and to broaden the use of our IP in new and unique platforms. As you know, we were chosen to be the technology provider for Xbox and for PlayStation. And we're going to take some of the work that we did there and extend it to other industry verticals and other opportunities. And that's something we feel that we're almost in a uniquely strong position to do. And when I put all of that together for our future goals, we believe that technology by its own sake isn't of and by itself enough. We want to take the technology we have and use it to actually really, really, genuinely help society and to further human experience. And you may have read or heard about some of the things we're doing with holograms and using HSA to do some really, really cool stuff for the future. And so those are our kind of a macro view on our plans and future goals.
You know, Roy, those are some really interesting plans. And I know that you were at CES in January. What was the reaction there?
Oh, we had a wonderful CES. I can't remember the last time I enjoyed myself at a trade show so much. I think that that one of the things that AMD has going for it is a tremendous sense of goodwill in the industry and in and around our ecosystem. So it was a really, really great CES. So many people rooting for us. Very, very exciting.
Now, you talked about all the tremendous plans that AMD has built on the sort of legacy of leadership over so many years and some innovative things that you're doing right now, which you also announced at CES and on this podcast. How does AMD further differentiate itself? I mean, it's a really, I would say, kind of a noisy environment, right? A lot of competitors.
Yeah, it's another great question. Thank you. If you step back and you look at the portfolio of IP that AMD has, we are unique in as much as we have a tremendous breadth of technology from CPU, GPU, APU, x86 architectures, and ARM architectures. And we have a portfolio of patents across all of those, and in audio and connectivity and so on. The ability to take all of those to produce award-winning, innovating standard products, but then also be able to offer them in semi-custom, I believe is unique. It's absolutely unique. And as it stands today, I don't believe that we have a competitor that is able to give the same breadth of IP and package it in a way that would give somebody, a company, a product which is unique and special for them. That's an extraordinary differentiation.
Now, you know, you talked about some of the things that you're trying to do to differentiate yourself, but it's a global environment, right? And the world has changed significantly in the past few years, particularly because of the internet. You know, what are your views on some of these global challenges?
Yeah, thank you again. The expression global challenges is an interesting one. For AMD, I believe that our global challenge is to, as I mentioned before, take the narrative and explain what we have. One of the ways that we're very, very keen to do that is to push and promote the use of fair and independent benchmarks in computing. Every day and every month and over the last years, we believe that billions and billions of dollars, which has been spent by governments, hospitals, schools, police authorities, every kind of municipal organization on IT, there could have been savings. And those savings could have happened if independent benchmarks had been used. It is our policy and part of our message to promote the use of benchmarks from a company like FutureMark. FutureMark is an independent company in Finland, and they produce independent benchmarks for the analysis of performance in PCs for 3D and gaming, with something they have called 3DMark, and in IT and computing and storage with a benchmark they have called PCMark. And they're now also working on independent benchmarks for servers. If these benchmarks were used, then we believe there would be a tremendous benefit for governments and countries around the world and for consumers in being able to make a fair and correct assessment about the technology that they're purchasing. Spreading that message is a global challenge for us. One I'm pleased to say we're making tremendous progress on. And we have a program internally called Project Justice, which is aimed at meeting with governments and meeting with authorities, especially those looking to place tenders for computer equipment, and promoting the use of FutureMark and these independent benchmarks so that they can make savings and consumers and people all around the world can benefit from a technology which meets their needs at a fair price.
You know, Roy, that sounds somewhat appalling that a situation would occur where there's unfair benchmarks. What led to that?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons as to why that might have happened. But certainly the challenge of explaining how products should be tested needed some help. And so the success of FutureMark in producing a benchmark system, which they could fund independently without influence, needed to be invented. And that took some time. So if you think about it from the point of view of a company investing in FutureMark or from FutureMark's executive team, they wanted to have a way for people to test fairly, but they needed funding. Under normal circumstances, any kind of funding they would get would immediately create a conflict of interest. So FutureMark invented something called a benchmark development program, whereby anybody that was a vested party or an interested party in the benchmark could invest in it and then have a say in the benchmark, have access to source code, and if they think there's something which is unfair, they can protest. And the benchmark doesn't get released. It's currently on its eighth iteration, the PCMark, for example. It doesn't get released until all the signatories of the program have joined in. Now, this is one of the ways that people know that it's fair. So the answer to your question was, it took time for that process to be developed and for FutureMark to be able to get all of the interested stakeholders to take part and agree to a system which was fair. But that's been done, and it does now exist, and so that's why we believe it should be used. That's our global challenge.
I can see, Roy, that as you've entered into this market and mining the information in there, testing out the ecosystem and the market conditions, this whole idea of fair benchmarks must have been a surprise to you. Are there others in the ecosystem or market conditions or areas that continue to surprise you today?
Yeah, there's three areas which continue to surprise me after more than 30 years in the industry. The first is that AMD is not used more widely. That is a surprise to me. I really do believe that our products should be, and I'm certainly going to try very hard to see that they are. But that's a first surprise to me. The second surprise is the pace of change. The pace of innovation is not only showing no signs of slowing down, if anything, it's continuing to speed up. And after so many years, the natural inclination is to think, I believe, that we've seen it all, we've done it all, whatever we try has been done before, and it's the same old thing. Nothing could be further than the truth. That is so wrong. In our industry, every single day brings something new, and that continues to surprise me in a wonderful way. The third thing that surprises me about the ecosystem and the market conditions is how much fun it still is. I'm having a tremendous, tremendous time, and most people I know that work in this industry also continue to really, really enjoy it. I don't see many people leaving this industry to go and do something else. And so it continues to surprise and delight me just how much fun it is to work in this area.
So what will you do next?
Well, for me personally, I have no plans to do anything next until this story is finished. For me personally, the exciting thing about being in technology is to be part of a story. But like most like stories do, they often have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So I stayed at NVIDIA until I thought the story ended, which for me it did, as the company moved into new areas that I was no longer excited by. At AMD, this story has just begun, just at the very beginning. So I think I'm going to be here for quite a while. When the time does come for me to personally move on, I think I'm going to write some books. I'm also very interested in making a movie about this industry, some documentary ones and some novels. And I'd also like to do some public speaking. I'd like to actually do a lot more public speaking about those global challenges we mentioned earlier.
The next question is sort of mining all of the things that you've done and the experience that you have and sort of the vision that you have of the future. So what do you see as the top upcoming disruptive innovations?
Yeah, I see five areas of disruption in the near future, the near to midterm future. The first area is in semiconductors, where I honestly believe that HSA, these heterogeneous system architectures, are going to make big changes. It might not seem like it today, and the reason for that is because for programmers and software companies around the world, we are just now getting into their hands these new architectures, which will allow a CPU and GPU to work seamlessly together with a shared memory architecture. As the software world learns to embrace that architecture and to take advantage of it, I believe we will see some rapid new innovation, and we will see applications that we never thought of before, and we will see these APUs used in ways that we never thought of before. For example, servers. The idea that you could use an APU in a server is completely new. So I think we're going to continue to see we're going to see some wonderful disruption innovation through that. The second area I think that we're going to see disruption is through something which is involved to remove disruption, which is the rise and rise of open standards. I'm very excited about what's happening with open compute. I'm also thrilled at the vitality and the strength of the Kronos organization. I think if you take great companies like Facebook and like Amazon and like Google, and you put those great companies together in a way where they can cooperate and support each other with open standards, I think that creates a platform where there's disruption is removed in terms of cooperation, but made possible by a standard platform which everybody can get behind. And so I think that Open Compute, OpenCL, and the bodies which Kronos is managing are going to create some wonderful new technology as well. So that's the second area. But the third area is going to be an experience. I am a tremendous fan of a company called Oculus, Brendan Areeb's company, where they are creating this virtual reality headset. I recently tried it out for myself, and I was initially skeptical, but once I tried it, I was just blown away. I believe that these headsets will make possible time travel. Now, by that, I don't mean that I'll be able to travel back in time, but the experience is so great, it's so profound, that you could re-enable almost any scene from history and feel as though you were virtually there. These headsets today are still tethered, which means they have to be connected to PCs. And they have some limitations. For example, when the headset is on your head, we still need to work out where your arms will be. But they will solve those issues. And as they do, the things that we'll be able to do by being able to virtually be somewhere or in any given situation will be highly disruptive and very exciting. The fourth area of disruption, which I'm really excited about, is in the area of health and in what I refer to as body form electronics. There's a company I'm tremendously keen on called MC10, with a CEO called David Icke. And this company has made wearable electronics, the likes of which I believe that most listeners to this podcast will never have seen. They have electronics which looks like a Band-Aid or a plaster, where I come from. And the power and the capability of what MC10 can put into something that you can wear like a Band-Aid is extraordinary, and it's truly extraordinary. And this is going to be very disruptive. I also think it could result in lower insurance costs, and I think and in better health for everybody. And that leads me to the fifth and final area of disruption, which I think is going to be in information. The ability to manage, examine, and extrapolate big data, information which is useful for the individual into little data, I think is going to be wonderful, and also for some people horribly disruptive. For others, wonderfully. There's a tremendous book called The Intention Economy by David Searles, which talks about how in the future the ability to interact little data for the individual with big data from organizations and companies will revolutionize the economy and the way that we interact with suppliers. So what I mean by that, for example, is in my day-to-day business, I don't think of Hertz as a supplier. And yet to me as a consumer, for myself, for personal vacation time, and for the company, Hertz are a supplier to me. The ability to use the intention economy and turn the interaction between big data and little data into a format where I can ask rental companies to bid for my business, I think it's going to be highly disruptive, and we're going to see some tremendous innovation. So those are the five areas: semiconductors with HSA, standards, the embodiment and the encouragement and the growth of standard bodies like Open Compute, experience through virtual reality and the work that Oculus is doing, health through form factors from companies like MC10, and then the intention economy through the interaction of big data and little data.
You know, those are some remarkable set of predictions and analysis of what you see as disruptive innovations. I know that in the health area, for example, it's a significant part of every country's GDP. So what you're describing can be have a significant impact on the world. And you talk about the Open Compute platform, and I was going to ask you a little bit later about free content, but let's ask it now. You talked about Open Compute and this whole idea of what's happening. So there is rapid growth in free content. What are your views on that?
Well, I believe that when you mention free content right now, that for the most part relates to movies and TV shows. I think the issues around free content or low-cost content in music have been largely solved. If you look at the TV and movie industry, and I personally live in Hollywood and know a number of Hollywood executives, I believe that I'll be a little controversial, the MPAA has not learned the lessons from the recording and audio industry. And I think that Kevin Spacey's speech at the Edinburgh TV Festival last August was wonderful. The book about Steve Jobs, I'm sorry, I've got the author's name for a second, it talks about the fact that Steve Jobs noticed, I'm trying to remember from the book exactly, so forgive me, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but the key point in the book was the observation that if you place a litter bin near to somebody, they won't litter. They'll put the trash straight in the can. And so that led to an indirect route to the concept that if you give people the content that they want, the way they want it, people will do the right thing. Not everybody, but by and large, people will do the right thing. The issue right now for the motion picture industry, for TV and for movies, is that people want stories just the way that Kevin Spacey talked about. And our appetite as humans for stories has not only not diminished, but it's increased. People don't want to steal, and they don't want to take free content that they shouldn't, but they can't get it any other way. And I think the best illustration of that is Game of Thrones. I think Game of Thrones is not, if not one of the most pirated, if not the most pirated TV show in the world. And one of the reasons for that is because the audience wants to see the show as soon as it comes out. And yet through different licensing agreements and other issues, they're prevented from doing so. I believe that if we can get that content to people the way they want to consume it, I think Netflix is showing the way, and binge watching is an unforeseen outcome from that. But if together the IT industry and Hollywood can help each other to get people's stories to them the way they want them, that is a great thing for people, and it's also a great thing for the IT industry and for the computer industry, which will help provide some of the formats for them to consume the stories.
That's just some fascinating answers there, and brings to mind a whole bunch of questions, but I'm just concerned about time. You talked about AMD and what you're doing, and how you have some really great sort of really innovative stuff that you want to share to the world. So, in view of that, can you talk about what you see as the top ICT growth regions internationally?
Yes. It's beyond doubt that China, although it's slowed a little recently, is still going to have a huge market and still growing. One of the things that's worth noting about China is that when we talk about the fact that some of the growth has slowed and some of the issues there, what's not often remembered is that that is taking place where it's been felt in the coastal cities along the east. In the middle of China and the west of China, it's still largely undeveloped, but has wonderful capabilities for continued growth and development. If we were to move the map around in our consciousness, although I'm British, I think the fact that we look at the world through with Britain in the centre because of historical reasons around time zones, if we were to move the world and put the centre of the world between Russia and China, you suddenly see a huge landmass and a huge area of growth. And I think that that China still has tremendous, tremendous upside because of this opportunity. The second growth area is what I consider to be New Europe, which is Russia and Turkey. Now, whilst Russia and Turkey obviously have some issues, if you look at their populations, the quality of their education, and the growth we've seen recently, I still see big upsides for Russia and Turkey. We also see tremendous opportunity in Africa. Interestingly, Africa has kind of moved, almost skipped PC in terms of notebooks and gone to mobile phones. And the phenomenon there with mobile phone money is very well understood. I believe that that's a very disruptive region, but with tremendous upside growth opportunity in IT, including in traditional PC platforms. And that's something I'd like to maybe return to when we have more time at a later date. And the last area of growth may surprise you is America. Over the last year, we have seen the American economy bounce back, and that includes in IT and the PC business. And I remain extremely optimistic about America's ability to continue to innovate and to bounce back. So those are the four areas of growth that I see internationally.
You know, it's interesting you talk about Russia and Turkey and so on, but, you know, the Russian region or the CIS countries, there's 250 million Russian-speaking people, highly educated. And in fact, when I spoke at the economic forum there, I think they were saying something like 80-85% of the people actually go on to post-secondary education, so much higher than here in the West. So, and you know, you mentioned China. In fact, this interview will appear in China, and just an exploding economy. It's about, what, $7.2 trillion, probably will overtake the U.S. Maybe next year, the year after, in PPP GDP, and maybe by 2025 will overtake the U.S. in nominal GDP. So, and then, as you indicated, the tremendous opportunity here in the U.S. In terms of growth in many different areas. So it, really interesting. I wish we had 2 hours. I could just explore that area in itself. I want to get sort of one other question about what's happening out there. And there's this whole idea of crowdfunding, and it's just exploding worldwide. In fact, the World Bank did a report on it in 2013. What are your views on that?
Oh, thrilled. Just a thrilling, just wonderful. I mean, if I sound enthusiastic, because I find it hard to contain myself. Crowdfunding made possible 3Doodler, and I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that quite correctly, but the 3D pen. And I don't know if you've seen that, but it's tremendous. I mean, just fantastic. Instead of a 3D printer, it's a 3D pen, and you can just build by yourself 3D objects with it. Tremendous success with crowdfunding. I also like very much Emotive Insight, which has a kind of running headset, which also came out of crowdfunding. Crowdfunding doesn't, however, only have the ability to give us IT startups innovation. Star Citizen, which is a game that we're involved in, AMD, with its wonderful creator, was also came out of crowdfunding. And we also saw, it was a little while ago now, how our crowdfunding made a movie possible, a movie called The Iron Cross from Finland. I think that the ability for innovators to get at the funds they need to produce brand new inventions without having to jump through some of the sometimes complex and stressful hoops of VC funding or angel funding is a fantastic new thing for us. And I think it's going to continue to do for IT what the invention of the stock exchange did for big business in the last century. But crowdfunding isn't only about invention and about IT. I also think if you look at what's happening with crowdfunding for microfunds for third world countries is also tremendous. I can't personally visit some of the cities in India and invest in some of the entrepreneurs there, but I can contribute to a micro fund that can, and I think that that is a tremendous, tremendous thing. It's a tremendous thing for IT. It's a tremendous thing for innovation. It's also a tremendous thing for the good of people, and I think that's terrific. I would like to see crowdfunding used to support new politicians. I'd like to see some new blood in our political system, but that, again, is for another day and another conversation.
Roy, you travel a lot. You are a hub of the ecosystem in some ways because of the success you have and continue to garner and because of the vision you have. So from all of your extensive speaking, travel, and work with AMD, can you share some interesting stories?
I picked three of my favorites. I once flew into the wrong airport. So I was late getting to Frankfurt Airport from a meeting. And I was talking to a customer on the telephone, and I was, and I'm afraid I'm a little embarrassed to repeat this, I was being a little rude to the lady at the ticket desk because I wanted to get an earlier flight home to get back for a dinner party my wife was putting together. Well, I told the lady at the ticket desk I wanted the next available flight to London, and she was a little cross with me but saw that I was distracted. So she kept me on the same airline, which was British Airways. Only she switched my ticket from Heathrow to Gatwick. And I was very busy on the phone. I didn't pay any attention whatsoever. I just looked at the gate number, didn't pay any attention to the flight number or the destination, sat down in my seat, finally switched the telephone off, and then landed at the wrong airport, which, since it was an early evening on a Friday, didn't go down very well. So that's one of my stories. The second story is going to seem incredulous to any millennial, But before 9/11, it was possible to sit at the front of the aircraft for takeoff and landing. There's a small jockey seat, which goes between the pilot and the co-pilot. And in those days, if you asked very nicely and you were very polite, they would let you go to the front of the aircraft to do that. And I was fortunate to do it around about a dozen times. Fantastic experience and very different to being in the back. And I guess my third story is about what I call non-coincidental coincidences. It seems incredible, but very, very often when I travel around the world, I find myself with people that I didn't know that I knew or connected to me. I've lost count of the times that I've sat down and somebody in front of me has sometimes been a competitor and started working, and I've had to politely ask them that to turn him not to work or to be aware that I'm there. I've also met relations I didn't know. Not recently, I met a second cousin, got talking to him, and then found out that we were related. And I'm told that mathematically this isn't actually that unusual. But I have dozens and dozens of instances of meeting people that I didn't know that I knew. So those are just some of my stories.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I guess you also have relatives dating back to Neanderthal and Denisovan, right? Because we actually carry their genes.
Well, I think we're only 6 degrees of separation, and now I read recently that it's only 4.3 because of social media.
Now, Roy, outside of your role at AMD, where you're just doing some amazing work, what are your three passions?
My first big passion is my family, and I have extended family. I live in America. I'm married to a wonderful Turkish lady, so I have family in Turkey, and then I still have family in the UK. Keep staying in contact with them and talking to them, which we do nearly every day, is a great passion of mine because I'm fortunate to have a family full of wonderful characters, and there are always stories. My second passion is reading, and you know, when we had dinner together at CES, I love talking to you about all the books and authors that we also love, and I have a library at home of over 3,000 books. And then my third hobby is running and hiking, although since joining AMD, I'm doing a little less running than I'd like. But I do like to escape to the mountains whenever I can.
Well, that's fascinating. Now we're down to the last question, and this is somewhat of an open-ended question in the sense that I actually turn the tables, and I say, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Yeah, I love this question too, and I think this has been my favorite interview for a long time, so thank you. The three questions I would ask, the first is, what are my favorite books and authors? I believe that if you know what somebody reads, you'll have an insight into them. I don't know what this will tell you about me, but my favorite fictional author is Bernard Cornwell, and his stories about English history. He interlocks history with novels, so I love his books. And then I love books on history, any history. I've done my British history, just done my Turkish history, and now I'm starting on my Chinese history. So I love that, and also technology. The second question I'd ask me are, who are my heroes? Who are the influences on my life, or the people that I most admire? And I have three of those: Winston Churchill, Oscar Wilde, and Atatürk, the man that brought Turkey into the modern age. All three of those are my heroes, and I studied them extensively. And my third question is probably one that I think should interest a lot of listeners of the podcast. And that is, if you're a young engineer in IT, electronics, semiconductor, or computer industry today, where should you go? Where should you set up your career? And the same question for salesmen. And the answer, I believe, is if you are a brilliant young engineer, whether it's semiconductors, IT, networking, data, comms, I believe that you should go either to Austin, Santa Clara, or Hsinchu in Taiwan. And if you're a young salesman, then I would advise you to go to either Beijing, Moscow, or Santa Clara. So those are the three questions I would have asked me.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just fascinating insights and lessons and advice to give to the audience. And this concludes our exclusive interview with this top world-leading authority, Roy Taylor, an innovating entrepreneur, an executive, and corporate vice president, head of global channel sales, AMD.